Welcome to Zero to Start, a podcast about immersive development that brings you inspiring conversations with immersive creators, developers, and industry leaders. I'm your host, Ceciliana Treviño. Roughly 90% of podcasts don't make it past episode 3. This holiday, we're celebrating our 25th episode of Zero to Start with a very special guest, Kent Bai, host of the Voices of VR podcast. Since May 2014, Kent Bai has published over 1,300 Voices of VR podcast interviews featuring pioneering artists, storytellers, and technologists driving the resurgence of virtual and augmented reality. Kent is an oral historian, experiential journalist, and aspiring philosopher, helping to define the patterns of immersive storytelling, experiential design, ethical frameworks, and the ultimate potential of XR. You can often spot him recording interviews and speaking at leading XR conferences, festivals, and immersive gatherings around the world. Voices of VR is a true community treasure and resource. Be sure to check out the link to Kent's Patreon, where you can support his work and gain access to his private Discord channel for Patreon supporters and more. Let's get started. Welcome to Zero to Start, Kent. It's such a delight and treat to have you on the podcast today.
Thanks for having me, Ceciliana. It's great to be here.
One of the aims of Zero to Start is to inspire potential creators and people who are curious about immersive technology to get started on their immersive journey. So the first question I like to ask is, what was your first aha moment with VR?
Well, I think I was watching a lot of YouTubes of Cymatic Bruce. This is back in 2014. And there was a number of different games that had been created in 2013. But there was like one educational experience that was about going around and looking at the different planets. And I thought, wow, this is a new field where you could start to have different types of experiences that people wanted to have. And so that inspired me to get a Oculus Rift DK1. I bought it back on like January 1st, 2014. And when I got it, I think it was just recognizing how immersive of a medium this was and how this was a completely new paradigm for how you could start to create different experiences and tell stories. And so I think from there, it was a matter of me going on what's been almost a 10-year journey now of trying to figure out what are all those ultimate potentials of this medium and what can you do with it. And so after recording over 2,000 interviews with people over the last 9.5 years and published over 1,300 of them, trying to get at the core of what is this medium, what are the affordances, what can it do?
I love that your first inspiration was a YouTube video, actually, and not trying a VR experience, because I just finished watching your primer on presence, immersive storytelling, and experiential design from September of last year. And that feels like another big aha moment for me, where a video of your taxonomy, your breakdown, your framework of how you are influenced by all of these interactions you've had, these experiences in VR, and distilling them, sharing them with the community through the Voices of VR podcast. What you've put together in this video helps invite people in to understand what is virtual reality. And in particular, if you could talk more about the qualities of presence that you formulated through all of these different philosophies.
Maybe it's good to go back to even where I started with thinking about presence, which was Mel Slater's 2009. He wrote this philosophical article, which was talking about the place illusion and plausibility illusion. And that was like a starting point where he was really trying to look at what are the things that are happening within VR that's different than any other medium. Place illusion is that you're in a different place and that place is real. And the plausibility illusion is that everything that is happening feels like it's actually happening. And so I was going on and seeing lots of different immersive experiences within the context of virtual reality. And I found that there was all these other dimensions of presence that weren't quite represented by the place illusion or plausibility illusion. There is this experience of like having these games and having this sense of agency. There was this experience of watching these immersive stories at these film festivals and having this deep sense of emotional presence. And I was trying to find an underlying framework to try to elaborate these different qualities of presence. And so I settled upon looking at the aspects of both the earth, air, fire, and water, and how there's long traditions from many different cultures, including the Western philosophy, history of Western philosophy, starting with the elements. But most people, when they think about the elements, they think of, well, that's a failed cosmology where the ancients used to think that the underlying nature of the universe was made out of these primal elements. But I think they're actually still really helpful when you think about it from the lens of phenomenology and lots of different traditions that have looking at like the water element being more about emotions, the earth element being more about the physical, tangible aspects of your body, your sensory experience, the fire element being all about agency and activity, and then the air element being all about the kind of mental processes, the language, the abstractions that we use to be able to communicate. And so as I was thinking about all this stuff, I started to map this over into what Mel Slater had with the place illusion and plausibility illusion, where the plausibility illusion was kind of like this more air element where you have this sense of mental presence, but there's also the air element of the social presence when you're able to actually connect and communicate with other people. So I think about the mental and social presence, you have this sense of actually connecting to other people in these different virtual environments. The thing about the way that Slater has framed these place illusion and plausibility illusion, it's all in this illusionary framing. And the illusionary framing goes back to Descartes and his evil demon, where what if you had an evil demon that was tricking you in all your different sensory experiences? And then that would be an illusion. And so there's a book that David Chalmers had written that was called Reality Plus, where he was both kind of looking at the history and evolution of this illusionary framing. And he has a lot of strong critiques against what Slater is doing with this kind of illusionary framing of presence. And I kind of agree with that. And just to briefly recount that is that there's a lot of Western philosophy that's based upon substance metaphysics, meaning that the only thing that's real is the thing that's physical, tangible reality of the hard concrete stuff. And I'm inspired by other metaphysical systems like process philosophy that says that the underlying nature of reality are these unfolding processes. And so there's a lot of people, when they talk about VR, they talk about, well, it's either virtual or it's real. But in my differentiation, I like to say that it's either virtual or it's physical. So there's a physical reality where you have different aspects of your sensory experiences, your haptics, that is still quite distinct and different, that you don't quite get the same type of experience within a virtual experience. And so in that sense, it's like that earth element of all the different sensory experiences of what it means to interact and engage with the world around us versus the thing that Slater was originally doing. He actually eventually expanded his two dimensions of presence out to the co-presence illusion, but also the virtual body ownership illusion. So the sense of embodiment. But again, it's all around this illusionary framing. And I guess one way to unpack why I think that's a problem is that you can have these virtual experiences and they could be just as real and just as meaningful as any other experiences you have in physical reality, especially when you have the sense of like agency where you feel like you have control and you're able to interact with the world around you, or you have these social interactions that feel very real and you have this sense of mental presence, this suspension of disbelief where you feel like you're really immersed into the world, and you have the ways that these experiences are impacting your emotions and your sense of emotional presence. It's that whole aspect of the embodiment and the environmental design where that's the biggest difference between the virtual versus physical, where you don't quite get as high fidelity of all the different haptics and the tastes, the smells, everything else that you might get if you're embedded in physical reality. So in essence, there's still, I think within the VR research community, this strong bias towards saying that unless it's in physical reality, then it's illusionary. And so, you know, even like the co-presence illusion, it's based upon like, well, you're not actually there with somebody, but if you got a phone call from, let's say, a friend or your family, you know, you wouldn't say, well, I had an illusionary conversation with my parents or my friends. You would say, I just had a conversation, but it was over the phone. It wasn't in face-to-face. So I feel like there's this subtle bias that has gone throughout the history of both Western philosophy.
A reality bias?
Well, no, just more of a bias towards substance, the substance metaphysics, like the only thing that's real is the physicality of reality. But there's other virtually mediated experiences that can feel just as real and just as meaningful, even if they don't happen in physical reality.
The imprint is the same.
Yeah. Your brain is basically recording all that information in a way that would be indistinguishable from, you know, whether it's kind of like this waking dream that we're able to invoke with these virtual experiences. So Chalmers is pushing back against that kind of illusionary framing in his book, Reality Plus. And I agree with Chalmers. And I think it was part of the limitations for how people would think about presence in the VR research community is that it was like these things that were impacting our neurology and our brains that were kind of tricking us. And so that's why it was maybe a little bit more bounded. But I think over time, I see how there's different design disciplines, like game designers are really about agency and interactivity, and the architects are all about, you know, designing spaces, and also theater is about the spatial dimension of performance with dance as well. And then you have the emotional presence with aspects of film, and then you have the human-computer interaction that comes from web design for the mental and social presence, but also the social media and all these kind of more web developers influence that's going to be coming in more and more as we move forward. So I think as you pull in all these different design disciplines, you have these different qualities of presence that you're kind of pulling in. And I think the essence of any good VR experiences is trying to blend all these different qualities of presence together.
What stage do you think we're at in terms of coexisting with virtual beings and having to manage multiple forms of presence? Because there's different forms of identity around those as well. In these worlds we're building, we have multiple identities that are designed and deprecated and sunset and then recycled and rebuilt anew. So there's this sense of regenerating our virtual identities. And I'm just curious where your framework fits within those identity management systems.
So in my overall experiential design framework, the qualities of presence and those four qualities that we've been talking about is like one like dimension. I have qualities, context, character, and story. And so the context is a lot of what I would say is connected to identity, because you have our bodies, you have our finances, you have the way that we communicate with the world, and as also our like early education, our home, our family, you have our entertainments, our hobbies, you have our medical condition or and state of health, you have our romantic partners, different experiences with death and grieving, but also our higher education, our ideas and our career, what we do for our job and our friends, and as well as all things that we may feel like exiled or aspects of ourselves that we keep hidden. So there's lots of different dimensions of our identity, where there's a whole paper that I just wrote about contextually aware AI and how that's like, there's all these privacy pitfalls for what Meta wants to create with contextually aware AI. And when you think about contextually aware AI, it's essentially this surveillance capitalism dream of Meta to be able to have these always on AI systems that are watching everything that we do on these egocentric perspectives of these AR glasses. And so we're kind of moving into the future where there's going to be all sorts of new data and information that is going to be fed into these systems. And a lot of what these like companies like Meta are trying to do, and in some sense, is because they're so focused still on advertising, is they want to try to psychographically profile us. And that essentially means that they want to try to find all the different dimensions of our identity and who we are in different contexts. And most privacy laws are focused on personally identifiable information, so what they would kind of legally define as PII. Those are all the things that are uniquely identifying you as an individual: your name, social security number, your email, your phone number. There's certain legal protections that come across PII. But when it comes to like more physiological data, like eye tracking data, that's something that's not necessarily protected, but you can start to infer all sorts of different information from these combination of all these aspects of this information that's coming off from our body. So I actually lean back onto the presence framework to start to identify, well, what are the threats of what kind of information you could extrapolate and infer about somebody by tracking our emotions, our behaviors, who we're talking to, our different social interactions, also what's happening with our body, the physiological and biometric data that may be systems like how fatigued we are, what we're paying attention to, what we're looking at. So all that information is essentially being fed into trying to profile us into all those different contextual dimensions of who we are on our identity. And so it's a big question around, you know, asking about identity, because it gets into all these different aspects of context and how VR and AR, if we just call it XR, extended reality, it's a very contextual medium, meaning that VR is trying to take us into a complete context switch. So I can be here at home and I can go into all these different imaginal worlds. And then AR is all about being in the center of gravity of your existing context. So you may be at work, but you may be starting to blend in other dimensions of context on top of that. But you're still going to be in the center of gravity of your existing physical context of the world around you. And you're going to be kind of overlaying and modulating, either amplifying this existing context or starting to mix and match other contexts on top of whatever you're doing at the moment. So context ends up being a really key part for understanding where both the identity part, but also the affordances of both VR and AR.
When alt space ended, there were these end of the world parties, and I would just spend a lot of time dressing up my avatar in different outfits and going to different parties. But it's just the way that I was thinking about ending the world in being able to wear as many different outfits and color combinations as I could. What does that mean for the future of how we exist? Are we going to just have all these different experiences with this virtual version of ourselves that we have to let go of constantly? And how is that different from just closing a tab on a website?
Yeah, well, I think it, you know, it's a really provocative question in the sense of, like, we do have these different dimensions of our identity that we're expressing in different contexts. You know, we go into alt space, we're one person. We, you know, just like who we are to our friends may be different than who we are at work versus who we are in our maybe religious or spiritual context. Or, you know, there's all these different dimensions of our identity that get expressed in different ways. And I think, you know, you even dress different ways if you're going to, like, say, Burning Man versus if you're going to a funeral. Those are different contexts in which that we're have different normative behaviors that we have. And so the great thing about VR is that you're able to dip in and out of all these different contexts and try on different identities, even if it's different avatars and ways that you're representing yourself, but also the social dynamics and networks that you are cultivating. To bring it back to the context, quality, character, and story, there's this quote that I always read from Robert McKee. There's this book that he wrote called Story, Substance, and Structure, Style, Principles of Screenwriting. And it's a quote that I think kind of gets to the essence of what it means to have these different dimensions of character and expression. And he's talking about storytelling, and he says that true character is revealed in the choices a human being makes under pressure. The greater the pressure, the deeper the revelation, the truer the choice to the character's essential nature. The way that I am breaking it down is that you're putting yourself into these arbitrary contexts, and you have to take choices and make action. And in those choices that you're making and the pressure that you're under, it's some ways revealing parts of your essential character. So by having all these different worlds to go into, they are, like, often arbitrary, contrived contexts that are based upon the rules. We may have different behaviors, but there may be some quintessential fundamental parts of ourselves that are consistent across all these different virtual worlds, where we may be going into all these different worlds and kind of saying, okay, what is unique to this context and very context specific, where I'm only operating this, like in, let's say, Assassin's Creed, where you're going around and basically murdering people in a way, but that's part of the game. You know, it doesn't mean that you're a murderer. It just means by the context of that specific game, you become an assassin. Or if you are playing Asgard's Wrath, which I've been playing the second version of that for the last week or so. And so what are the different types of things that you like to do? Do you like to go on quests? Do you like to be a completionist? Do you like to, you know, find all the secret treasures? You know, there's certain behaviors of Bartle has these different player archetypes that, you know, you are either like an achiever or explorer or a killer or a socializer. So those kind of map roughly over the different degrees of presence, where, you know, socializer is a lot about interacting and engaging and socializing with people. The killer is like trying to push the limits of agency and interactivity. And then there's the other qualities of the explorer, which is just like looking at the environment and the world design. And the achiever is trying to, less concerned around the characters of the world, but more concerned around achieving all the different goals that are set up, and to be a completionist and do all the different side quests and everything. So there's these different player archetypes that you may fall into, but given these different virtual experiences, you have an opportunity to kind of dip your toes into these different levels of character archetypes that you might want to explore. And some of it may be just, like I said, a completely contrived context. And other times you may be walking out of the experience and then eventually noticing this is the consistent part of, like, the quintessential nature of who I am as a person.
This way that we're able to engage with virtual reality, try these different identities, role play, and have all these different senses of presence, the way to preserve 3D worlds is through photographs and video. So if we're holding on to memories of virtual worlds that no longer exist, it's going to be through a photograph, which is so, you know, last century.
VRChat, when it first launched, it had very quickly, well, within the first couple of years, it had integrated like the capacity to make a 360 photo capture. They've recently taken that out, but I think with the Apple Vision Pro and the integration of like spatial videos that are being captured, I think there's, especially with the phone, I think we're going to see a lot more people using their iPhone 15 or whatever latest Apple Vision Pro that they may have and starting to actually capture spatialized memories in a way that is able to capture and remind ourselves of these different experiences we have in physical reality. And I think it, as the tools get developed for people to actually experience some of those different photo captures, I mean, it's been about 10 years in now that we've been into the kind of modern resurgence of virtual reality. And we've had all sorts of different capacities for using these 360 video capture. And it's mostly been focused on gaming is to be able to experience VR, but there have been tools to be able to experience 360 video and other ways of capturing these spatialized memories. It just hasn't been as widely adopted yet. But I think over time, as more and more people start to take photos and spatialized photos of their lives, photos are weird because sometimes you take a photo and it doesn't mean as much until like enough time has passed. And then you look back and it's a kind of a capture of a moment in time that you're grateful that you took the photo, but at the moment, or maybe even for 2 or 3 or 5 or 10 years, the photo increases in value the more time that passes because it is able to teleport you like a portal into these memories. And there are people that have been taking these more spatialized captures within VR, but like I said, I think it's more of a display. And I think with the Apple Vision Pro, it's going to maybe close the loop a little bit because people have iPhones and they've been taking panoramic photos, and there's just going to be more of a tight integration with the phones and how people have already been using the phones. And once that's put into more of a spatialized context, I predict that's going to be one of the biggest revelations of people using these immersive media that goes way above and beyond what Meta's been able to do, just because they don't have like such a tight integration with these devices that we've had. So yeah, I think it's a matter of time before we start to see more of that type of memory capture, and it evolved into more spatialized audio with the Ray-Ban Meta smart glasses that just came out. They have the ability to capture spatialized audio, which is really quite compelling. So doing more spatialized audio capture as well as volumetric video, and also this whole movement of Gaussian splats, which is more of a still life capture of, you know, being able to take these volumetric capture of things. The tools are, the Gaussian splats was just announced in August of 2023. So it's only like a few months in, but it's essentially like a new render pipeline for XR that's going to completely revolutionize the way that we do volumetric capture. So I predict that there's going to be a lot more tools that are going to be used for people using these kind of new render pipelines that are based upon point clouds, but are able to render stuff in a way that's much higher fidelity than what we've seen in, say, photogrammetry techniques.
That alone is pretty incredible. When you think about, again, what you're talking about from 2014 to now and how rapidly things are able to be in your pocket. Whereas before it was, you know, even with the evolution of bullet time in the Matrix to volumetric capture to being able to do a Gaussian splat with your phone. Doesn't it just blow your mind?
Well, you know, a lot of what I've been trying to figure out over the last 10 years is what is the ultimate potential of all these technologies? And one of the big conclusions I came to is that we have no idea what's going to happen with XR or with AI or with all these things that are developing. But what we do have a better sense of is if we look at through the lens of the human experience and look at what does it mean to be human in these different qualities of presence, these different contexts in which we live, these different character traits of who we are and how we express ourselves, but also the processes that are unfolding and the stories that we're telling. And that if we look at the dimensions of the human experience, that has been pretty consistent over many, many decades and hundreds of years and arguably millennia, that the essence of the human experience is pretty much the same for a long period of time. We might start to expand our senses with these technologies and add new senses into the pantheon of what it means to be human. And I think that's going to be something that's totally unpredictable for things like sensory addition and sensory replacement. But I think if we want to try to understand the future trajectory of where technology is going, then I think by looking at just the fundamental aspects of the human experience will be a pretty good map to say, even if, you know, the earlier question you're asking about AI and virtual beings, well, there'll just be new ways of capturing the gestalt of all human knowledge that gets embedded into like these large language models in a way that's not perfect yet. It's like a proxy for just predicting what the next probable word is, but it does a pretty good job of kind of mimicking different aspects of human knowledge without really having any deeper sense-making or planning capabilities. But if you just like look at the fundamentals of virtual beings, what it means to have these social interactions and how those social interactions can deepen your sense of a story or what's it mean to be embedded within the context of a world, then you can start to extrapolate, okay, well, this is what the future is going to look like with these different elements of the human experience that are interacting with the cutting edge of where the technology is going in the future.
I think that makes me feel a little bit better, honestly, because sometimes when I'm talking to people, I just get this sense of like, wow, we really don't know what's going to happen. But then you say, okay, well, people have been telling stories around the campfire since the dawn of time.
If you look at the different evolutions of, you know, the ways that we've told stories, whether you're standing around a campfire and people are telling those stories, well, eventually, you know, I don't know the exact history for when theater started to come up, where there was more perhaps theatrical ways of telling stories. And then eventually when people were able to write down information in books, and with the printing press, that was a whole revolution for how you're able to capture stories and be able to capture the essence of human knowledge as well. And then eventually, you know, in the turn of the century from the 1890s to into 1900, in the turn of the 20th century, we have film and then radio and then television and video games and the internet, mobile phone, and now with virtual reality, augmented reality, and different aspects of immersive theater, there's a continuation of all these different mass communication mediums. And with each of those revolutions of mass communications, they've essentially been like a center of gravity. Like, say, video games was all about agency. But at the same time, video games were incorporating different lessons from film and lessons from radio and books, theater, oral storytelling. So each subsequent media is incorporating the lessons of the previous medium, but it's doing something new. It's adding new affordances and new dimensions of presence. So with VR, AR, and immersive theater, it's adding aspects of architecture and spatial contexts that are able to be put into a mass communication device. Whereas usually when you have architecture, you'd have to actually go to a physical place. But now we have the capability of delivering architecture to you in the context of these VR experiences. So you have this whole new dimension of mass communication in a spatial context that we haven't had before that is new. So for a lot of the work that I've looked at is to look at each of these previous media and what is the affordance of those media, and then how does that informing VR, but how is VR taking that above and beyond what any other previous media is doing? I think those qualities of presence that we were talking about at the top is really some of the differences that we see. Although, you know, say emotional presence, all the media have different aspects of emotional presence. And like, say, active presence, well, video games have had a lot of dimensions of active presence. And so, you know, that's a part of the reason why, going back to Mel Slater, he said that the place illusion and plausibility illusion, those were the things that were completely new and different with VR. And arguably, perhaps the co-presence illusion and the virtual body ownership illusion, where you can actually have a sense of your body in these places and have feeling like you're hanging out with other people in the same physical context, even though it's a virtual context, and you have the sense of being co-present with them with all these dimensions of our body language. So yeah, for me, I go back to these different mass communication media and just understand that no media ever completely supplants the previous media, but it's like taking the lessons and it's transcending the limitations and including something that's new.
Shifting gears a bit, you had mentioned that you're playing Asgard's Wrath 2. The first one came out on the Rift.
Asgard's Wrath is like, they said it's around 130 hours if you were to play through it. I don't know if there's been a VR game that's been this big. And so I've been kind of immersing myself trying to understand what they're doing in terms of all these different qualities of presence. You know, it's a great story architecture where they have different dimensions of, say, Egyptian mythology or Norse mythology, where you play a god and you're interacting with different gods, but you go into the mortal realm and there's different puzzles where you shift back and forth between god scale and human scale. But it's an open world, so there's a lot of different options that you have, where a lot of games that have come out have been very linear, where you don't really have a lot of choice to do what you want to do. So there's main quest lines that you can go and do, and there's essentially a gameplay loop of going through having battles, and then you go into like solving puzzles, and then there's little bits of narrative that you get rewarded with at the end. And also there's a whole vast like environmental design that is really quite beautiful. So you get rewarded by exploring all these really vast architectures, and just kind of seeing the spatial design that they have is really one of the best. Since like Half-Life's Alyx, I think, has set the bar for me, but I feel like this is on par, not from a visual fidelity level, because PC VR is just so much greater, but in terms of the vast and the scope of the game, it's like a lot more rich than, say, Half-Life Alyx, which is a pretty linear experience, where this ends up being a little bit more of an open world experience.
I tried the first one, and I'm not super into that type of game, but I really enjoyed the time I spent in there, and it was something that I was finding myself going back to.
Yeah, I didn't play the first one. There was a lot of things that I was like, when I think back, I went on like 18 different trips in 2019. I was doing a lot of work on ethics and traveling and speaking a lot. And then the pandemic happened and I kind of went into a different mode. I personally have not played a lot of VR games over the years. I've been more focused on the story aspect of it. So I go to a lot of like film festivals like Sundance and South by Southwest, Tribeca, Venice Immersive, IFA Doc Lab, where there's a lot of like cutting edge innovation when it comes to telling really deep and meaningful stories. So I've missed that in a lot of games in the past, but I feel like we're at a point now where I'm starting to see a lot more of that integration of narratives into games that make it more sticky for me personally. There's a lot of games that I've played a lot in the past, like Tetris Effect, or I'll jump into Rec Room and play a lot of different PvP type of experiences. But yeah, I feel like the stories aspects are something that really hooks me in. There's a game that just came out this past week that I think was kind of not really getting a lot of attention, but it premiered at Venice Immersive and I had a chance to play through all of it. It's a Wallace and Gromit grand adventure. And it's kind of a cute little game that, if you're familiar with the IP of Wallace and Gromit, there's a lot of things that I think fans will appreciate. I was personally not very familiar with it, but having another dimension of like a story and storytelling and seeing different modes of how you tell stories in VR is something that I'm really quite interested in. So the ones that have like a little bit more narrative components, I tend to be a little bit more sticky for me.
It's interesting with how challenging making a VR experience can be to have a game like Gorilla Tag succeed and go viral to become the most rated experience on the Quest store. And I think also on App Lab, where it launched this last month, Gorilla Tag showing up with like a million users for the month. Last year, they made like $26 million in sales for digital goods. Have you tried Gorilla Tag?
I've played it a little bit. I'm not very good at it. And it's also very exhausting. So I haven't got to the point where I'd say I've like successfully like won a round, but I've played half a dozen or a dozen rounds of it.
The first time I tried to play, I couldn't get out of the cave, so I just gave up. But finally, I did manage to make it out of the cave, and I just got the Christmas update and have been really enjoying the sort of novel way to move around and feel like I can swing through the trees and just do all these really weird parkour moves. And there's not a lot of fuss with the gorillas. Like, you can just, you're just a gorilla. Everybody's a gorilla. Have you interviewed the...
No, I haven't. I haven't. I know that they, it's quite an amazing story, but I've been... Actually, I just did an interview with the producer of Asgard's Wrath, Mari Kyle, who works at Oculus Story Studios. So I feel like over the last like 2 or 3 years, I haven't been doing as many interviews with like the gaming side, but I feel like probably be a good time to start coming back into it, especially as there's more and more games that are a little bit more interesting to me, at least for now. But yeah, it's an amazing story of how it was kind of like secluded off in the App Lab for such a long time. And I feel like there's something that, just like Beat Saber is, and Supernatural as well, where people use it for like as a form of exercise, but it ends up being like a very visceral embodied experience that's very unique to VR. So from what I've seen of Gorilla Tag, where you're swinging your arms to be able to locomote, there's something that gives this sort of embodied experience that perhaps like reduces the motion sickness a little bit, but also gives you this deep, visceral, embodied experience. A lot of the melee and the kind of gameplay that's within Asgard's Wrath has a lot of sophisticated combinations of both the embodiment of moving your body around, but also the abstractions of pushing buttons. And so combining those in a way that is tricky enough that, and also is evolving over the course of the 100 plus hours So I feel like there's, you know, ways that you're actually putting your body into the experience that some of these games that have gone viral are kind of unlocking different dimensions of what it means to be adding this dimension of embodiment and virtual bodies into these immersive experiences. One of the things that I have been developing this kind of framework for presence, I've been really in the cauldrons of immersive storytelling. And the problem with that is, well, the great thing is that it's been a lot of the cutting edge innovation for where the future of the medium is going, I think. But the challenge is that only about 5 to 10% of those experiences that I've seen, hundreds of them now, are even widely available for folks to take a look at and watch. And so it ends up being like difficult to translate some of these different concepts. And so I think part of the things that I'm going to be doing moving forward is to look at these bigger experiences. Part of the reason why I've been spent like 35 hours on Asgard's Wrath over the last week or so. So just really immersing myself into the game and trying to really understand, okay, this is really compelling. Why is it compelling? Well, the environmental design is amazing. Well, the, you know, these different gameplay loops, you have RPG elements of gathering resources and upskilling and these different choices you have with these side quests that you can do. So thinking about it through these different qualities of presence and the economy that they have, the resources that they have. I've also spent a lot of time playing Roblox with my nephew-in-law and going in and playing in different experiences of being actually in VR into different experiences, seeing the limitations, you know, and I've spent quite a lot of time in both Rec Room and as well as VR chat to see what's happening in the culture of VR chat, especially with festivals like Raindance that have featured a lot of different best of class of different immersive art and immersive stories and the music scene that's happening there. So for me, I've been really attracted to the arts and culture aspects of virtual reality, especially like the storytelling aspects. And there hasn't been really a lot of other people that have been covering what's been happening at these film festival circuits. So it ends up being like me traveling around the world, going to these places, seeing all these different experiences, talking to creators, and trying to distill down how can I start to archive these experiences that are kind of like theatrical performances where not very many people will have a chance to witness or experience them themselves. And so how can we find a way of talking about this experience that allows them to understand what the experience is? But I think I'm also getting to the point where now that I have this like framework, starting to go back and look at some of the more widely available experiences like Asgard's Wrath, like, you know, Gorilla Tag at some point, and start to do a little bit more of a deeper dive into what's happening in the consumer scale of applying these different ideas and concepts.
Your work is such a treasure to the community and a true masterclass in the evolution of virtual reality, what it means for storytelling and philosophy. Tell us how we can support you on Patreon and subscribe on YouTube and all the other places that you're sharing your content.
Yeah, well, I've been very fortunate to have a lot of support through my Patreon for many, many years now. And that's the core of a lot of the income that I get. I do get some speaking fees where I travel around and speak, but having a consistent support of Patreon allows me to continue to be like an independent scholar, an independent researcher, and to focus on the corners of XR that either not a lot of the other folks are looking at, things like immersive storytelling, what's happening on the festival circuit, and really trying to stay on that beat, but also other aspects of ethics and privacy and, you know, a lot of things that are trying to look at both the potentials and perils. And there's a lot of potential perils that are happening with XR. It was the WebXR Polys Awards where they had this Ombudsman Person of the Year. And so I was the inaugural winner of that award. And then Avi Barzeev and Britton Heller and Michaela Mantenga. So we had a whole kind of group discussion talking about ethics. So there's a lot of stuff that I'm like thinking about, both from experiential design, immersive storytelling, ethics. So yeah, a lot of the support that I get on Patreon is helping to sustain that work and also start to do a little bit more writing. So I hope to add more access to some of these different talks and different pieces of writing and potentially even start to gather more in the new year. So there's kind of a festival cycle that I go through with like South by Southwest. And then we have like Tribeca that's happening, and then Venice Immersive, and then IFA DocLab. So there's the different events that I go to. There's also AWE. So there's kind of like a cycle that I go through, and there's a few months that I have between now and the next traveling I'm going to be doing in March, that I can go back through some of these. Like I have 8 different series that I'm going to dive into, from both medical XR, Augmented World Expo. There's trips that I did from Laval Virtual and New Images in France. Also, IFA Doc Lab. And I just went to Filmgate Miami. And there's Broadcast Education Association. So talking to folks in higher education and how they're using it. So there's about 8 series that I want to try to get out in the next like 2 to 3 months or so before I start up again. But yeah, so focusing on these different series of these different interviews, but also I think at some point doing more explicit adventures or gatherings. I read the book, The Art of the Gathering, which was by Priya Parker, that talks about what does it mean to have a good gathering. I haven't necessarily announced anything or put anything into place just because I've got so much of...
You're a busy guy. You're working.
I'm a busy guy and I'm pretty hermited. As much as I am very social, my social interactions are very one-on-one and very deep dive conversations. So even though I do go to these events, when I'm at home, I kind of don't end up interacting as much and I kind of go into my cave and produce all these podcasts that I've been recording. So I've been able to record over 2,000 interviews, only published 1,300 of them, which means that there's hundreds of unpublished interviews, including ones that I've had with you in the past.
Indeed.
So there's a...
the vault.
Yes, there's a backlog and a vault that I can record interviews a lot faster than I can produce them. But also, I was producing a daily podcast for a while.
Oh my, no.
And I was like, is this too many podcasts? And people are like, yes, this is too many. So then I slowed down how many I was publishing, but I didn't slow down how many I was recording. So that sort of has led to this huge archive of the history of VR that is the unpublished archive of Voices of VR that I also hope to get out at some point, just because I think it's a part of the history.
Well, that would be even like a special achievement to unlock, right? At a certain contribution level, you could unlock the archives that have yet to be published.
Yeah. One of the things I need to just sort of reach out to my community and see what type of things they'd like to see, what type of events or other types of experiences. I've started to do a little bit more writing. One of the things I want to do is, like I said, start to apply some of these different ideas of experiential design to existing experiences. And so whether that's video or other talks, and even the coverage that I did at Venice Immersive, I ended up doing over 30 hours of interviews, believe it or not, on my trip to Venice, around 32 hours of interviews in my 10 days of being there. So there is about 43 experiences and a little over 20 hours worth of content that I needed to see. I saw about a third of it ahead of time based upon stuff that I'd already seen or stuff that was available. But it ends up being like a really intensive immersive experience to try to watch, to binge watch it, what is essentially like 10 to 15 hours worth of immersive stories in 2 days. And then for the rest of the 8 days, do like 30 hours of interviews with folks. So I go all in. I feel like I'm, I guess, a speed runner when it comes to trying to see, like a binge watcher speed runner, mm-hmm. of trying to see all the different experiences. It's kind of like a game that I play with basically myself. And
people can't keep up. Like, who can keep up with that?
There are some other people that do end up watching all the other experiences. But at Venice, I ended up publishing 30 hours of content and did a whole 3.5-hour Critics Corner where I invited 3 other people that had seen a significant, either all the other experiences or a critical mass of them, and to just be able to talk about each of the different dimensions of the experiences and stories. And so, yeah, just trying to, I guess, raise the level of critical discourse of what's happening in these spaces, because a lot of these people are creating these pieces. And I like to just, you know, provide a context where we do a little bit of a deep dive of allowing people to talk about themselves, tell their story, to talk about the story they're telling, to be able to talk about their processes by which they are creating the story. And then for me to be able to weave in my own reactions to their experience.
You are going to be celebrating your 10-year anniversary. Over the course of experiences that you've seen and interviews that you've had over the last 10 years, is there anything that surprises you as you look back on your work?
Yeah, I bought my DK1 on January 1st, 2014. So 10 years on January 1st, but then like May 6th to like May 19th is when I like really kickstarted the Voices of VR. So in May, I'll be celebrating 10 years of doing the Voices of VR. One of the things that I've said about the ultimate potentials about VR is that we're going to be able to go into an immersive experience and come out of an experience knowing more about ourselves. And So I think whenever an experience is able to actually achieve that, it becomes like a landmark piece, even if other people don't have the same experience. If something is able to really unlock a key insight about who you are and why you're here, I think that is a huge achievement. So there's definitely been pieces that have been able to start to unlock little fragments like that with me. Things like the Collider that I had a chance to do a couple of times from both perspectives, where you essentially go into this asymmetrical experience and you are either occluded within VR and having other people outside of you kind of move around and essentially kind of puppeteer you like a marionette. And so the piece is really about power and control and how, who's in power, who's in control, and are you being controlled by other people, and what are the boundaries that you have with that? So it's a piece that is exploring issues of power and boundaries and going into it and coming out, kind of realizing all these deeper insights about my own relationship to power, my own relationship to boundaries. Yeah, there's stuff like that where I feel like there's so many different potentials of VR. I mean, I did a whole like hour-long talk at South by Southwest this year where I dive into both the promises and perils. And my episode 1000 dives like a whole 3-hour exploration of all the different mini potentials of VR. But for me, I think the essence of it comes down to like, VR has the potential to help you be more connected to yourself, more connected to others, connected to all dimensions of reality, and like connected to the world and the earth around us. And the essence of it, like we can be more connected to ourselves and other people through the medium. You know, Michael Mead has this whole thing where he talks about people finding their gift, their genius, their daimon. You know, what is it that you came here to contribute to the world? And I feel like we're all trying to figure out what is the thing that we are able to really contribute or uniquely live into our gifts. And I think that what I'd love to see as we move forward is that VR provides these new opportunities for people to express themselves or to find whatever their gift is, whether it's creating experiences, whether it's, you know, creating philosophical frameworks or being able to provide an immersive experience for someone that so revelatory that it gives them a new insight on the nature of reality. So there's so many different ways that people could contribute to where this medium is going. And I always like to say, you know, Beat Saber completely revolutionized so many different dimensions of the VR industry. And it was like created by 3 people. So, you know, these small teams still have this power of being able to fundamentally shift the entire trajectory of where the medium goes in the future. And that's still true today. There's still so many untapped potentials for what the medium can do, what's possible. So anybody that's listening to this has an opportunity to have their take on that. What is it that they want to see that isn't existed yet? Or how can people express themselves and live into their true gifts? And I think to me, that's essentially like we're here to evolve and grow and to be able to be connected to each other, but also to live into our deepest purpose for why we're here as humans. So
for the time that we have.
Yeah, exactly.
Did you have anything else you want to share as far as your hopes, wishes, and dreams for 2024?
The intention that I have is to continue to get out more of these different series and more of these different interviews and works. But yeah, I think thinking also a lot about, you know, different ways of stuff that I want to create and make VR experiences, but also different gatherings that I may want to have with my patrons. And so I feel like there's different context switches that I'd go through, either through creating or producing. And I feel like 2024, maybe a year where I start to expand out in different mediums. I've already done a little bit of writing at the end of 2023. So whether that's writing, I feel like I have like at least one or two books in me. So like continuing to chip away.
I'm laughing because I just, the level of output that you have is so inspiring and it's so thorough.
Yeah, I think that, like I said, the challenge is that there's a theory and practice of experiential design where there's a lot of trying to decode the deeper patterns that I've seen by seeing all these different experiences and trying to come up with an abstraction and a framework that helps to describe all the different dimensions and elements of immersive experiences. And yeah, whether it's kind of applying that in different ways, applying it to privacy or starting to look at some of these bigger experiences and have it in a way that people can ideally have this experience of having their own embodied experience with stuff and then to be able to read and understand the framework to help to unpack different dimensions of their own experience and to maybe understand why something is a little bit more compelling than something else. Because we all have our preferences of what we like, we don't like. But to be able to articulate that, I think it's into like this deeper critical framework that there's not like a universally accepted aspect for how to even talk about these different immersive experiences. I feel like the experiential design framework I'm putting forward is like a first step and the thing that I personally use. But yeah, there's a theory and practice of making VR experiences. And I feel like there's been a lot of practice, but I think a lot of the work I'm looking to do is to continue to deepen those deeper theoretical aspects to be able to create these archetypal structures that we can use to help make sense of both these experiences, but also the inherent trade-offs of experience, but also what makes something compelling or what makes something work or not work.
Thanks so much, Kent, for joining me. It's truly been an inspiring conversation, and I'm really excited for the year ahead, and I wish you all the success on your writing and podcasts and travels in the year ahead.
Awesome. Thanks so much, Ceciliana. Thanks so much for having me on. It's been a real pleasure to be able to dive deep into a lot of the work that I've been doing. So thanks so much.
I hope this episode inspires you to explore Kent's primer on presence, immersive storytelling, and experiential design to discover how his critical framework can help elevate your creative vision and reveal new truths that inspire more connection and growth. Be sure to check the show notes for links to Kent's Patreon, YouTube, and more. You'll also find links to what we're playing in VR this holiday. You can support Zero to Start by subscribing to us on your favorite podcast platform. Give us a rating and share this episode with your community. Thanks for listening. Until next time, peace on earth and goodwill to all. Happy New Year.